match study results. And I'd like to thank the organizers for extending us an offer to come and speak to our preliminary results. In terms of full disclosure, I have received funding as a co-principal investigator for the phase one studies involving the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. I'm an investigator on the Moderna and Novavax phase three studies, and I receive NIH funding as chair and site PI for the mix and match study. So some key decisions need to be made in regards to decisions for the late boost, and a variety of data is going to contribute to this decision. So our role in this process is to understand how to use current vaccines to be used as boosts. And the questions are, can one vaccine be used as a boost to a different vaccine? Is it safe to mix vaccines? And what happens to the immune response after booster vaccination? So our trial is primarily safety and immunogenicity. We do not have data on vaccine efficacy. And before I start, I'd like to recognize the mix and match study team. My co-chair is Dr. Robert Atmar at the Baylor College of Medicine. And we have 10 sites who are part of the IDCRC network funded by NIH. We have data and statistical support through SHARP in Seattle, and our regulatory support is FHI 360. And we're fortunate to have a number of laboratories helping us with this project. So we have David Montefiore at Duke University, who's contributing with the neutralizing antibody results. We have Adrian McDermott at the VRC, who's contributing binding antibody results. And we have ongoing cellular and B cell responses, as well as live viral neutralization assays that are pending at this time. Okay, so the study design in our population are volunteers who received EUA COVID-19 vaccine at least 12 weeks since the last vaccine dose. And this timing was driven by the urgency to have data available in the autumn. So we realized that longer intervals generally result in better immunogenicity, and we felt that this was the minimum interval in which we could have good immunogenicity results and be able to look at things in a systematic in an unbiased fashion. So each group has 50 participants, and our group is defined as the primary vaccine series followed by the booster. And they're equally stratified between a younger age cohort of age 18 to 55 and an older cohort who are greater than or equal to 56 years of age. And that number gives us a high probability of observing at least one adverse event with a true event rate between 2 and 10%. However, it will not capture uncommon or rare adverse events. We've designed this trial to inform public health decisions, but it's not powered to design or designed to compare between groups. This is an adaptive design, and I'm only reporting the first 9 groups, but we have additional arms that are ongoing at this point. And it's divided for these first 9 groups, which I'm going to present today, into 3 stages. And each stage is comprised of 50 individuals who had previously been dosed with the Janssen primary series, 50 individuals who were dosed with the Moderna regimen, and 50 who received Pfizer-BioNTech. And then these groups of 3 were then boosted with a single vaccine. So groups 1 through 3 received the Moderna at the full dose, 100 microgram dose. We do have additional arms that received the 50 microgram dose, and we don't have those results currently, but will down the line. Groups 4 through 6 received the Janssen at full dose boost, and groups 7 through 9 received the Pfizer product. All volunteers had been dosed from their final dose at least 12 weeks. The study visits occurred on day 1, day 15, and day 29, and those are the results that I'm going to present today, but we will be following them months 3, 6, and 12. In terms of volunteer characteristics, we had an N of 458 over the 9 groups, and it broke down between 49 and 53 individuals per group. All of these individuals self-professed to having not had COVID-19 infection and denied having monoclonal antibody infusion. We were fairly equally distributed in between males and females. The age ranged from 19 to 85 years of age. We had a predominant Caucasian population, with about 7% being Asian and roughly 7% Hispanic. We did note that two participants, one in group 4 and one in group 6, had high N protein antibody levels at day 1, suggestive of a prior infection, presumably asymptomatic. And we had one participant in group 5 who had a symptomatic COVID-19 event at day 27. This was uncovered after the immunogenicity results had been calculated, although we did look at their day 29 N protein, which did not appear to be elevated at that time. I'm highlighting here the interval. The interval changed throughout the stages, as this was a sequential staged recruitment. So in the early stage 1, we had a bit of a difference between the Janssen volunteers of approximately 2 weeks shorter in interval as compared to the two mRNA, probably owing to the fact that Janssen received EUA in late February. And here we have the time from vaccination to boost in the stage 1, 2, and 3. And you can see that for stage 1, the volunteers had just under 4 months as the interval between their last dose and boost, all the way to stage 3, where the interval had increased to approximately 6 months, or just under 6 months. So increasing interval with the sequential stage recruitment. In terms of immunogenicity, so we have available data through day 15 and in some cases day 29, which I'll present here today. In green are the results that I'm going to present. I've mentioned that we have the Montefiore lab processing our neutralization assays, and we'll be reporting those in ID50s, ID80s, and then we bridge them to the international standard and report this as international units, or IU50, IU80. I would also state that this is a pseudotype lentivirus presenting the protein spike of variant of interest and has a luciferase expression system. So this is a validated assay for D614G, and we performed analysis in all 450-plus volunteers. We also have subset analysis for variants of concern, which are in process but not available to be discussed today. Similarly, the Vaccine Research Center in the McDermott Lab provided analysis for the IgG antibody using a validated fourplex assay, assessing the WA1 or Washington-1 circulating wild-type strain in all volunteers, reporting this as arbitrary units, but we also did bridge this to the international standard known as binding antibody units. We also did a 10-plex fit-for-purpose research assay, and we analyzed the control circulating wide type, as well as the alpha and the delta, which I'll present today. Okay, our first set of results are going to be the full-dose Moderna booster. And let me take a little time to sort of outline this. I know it's a busy slide, but they'll all be sort of similar in terms of the next few slides. And so what I'm presenting here are serum antibody responses. Here are the ends. At the top panels, you'll see the entire age group collapsed together. And in the bottom, we have subgroup analysis. So in blue, we see the age 18 to 55-year-old subgroup. And in red, we see the 56 years and older subgroup. Also, we have the time points across the x-axis, so days 1, 15, and 29, and this is a logarithmic scale. Across the top, we have their primary series, Janssen, Moderna, and Pfizer-BioNTech. In blue, we're reporting the geometric mean titer, as well as the binding antibody unit bridged to the international standard. And then in red, we're reporting the geometric mean fold rise. And so what I would first say in regards to the mRNA 1273 booster product is that at baseline, all volunteers had detectable binding antibody. It was highest in the Moderna group, followed by the Pfizer, followed by the Janssen. But following boost, we had a robust response across all three primary vaccine series, ranging from approximately 7 all the way up to 56 geometric mean fold rises And peaking at day 15 and then remaining stable at day 29. Okay, the next set of results are our neutralization and antibody titers to the spike DD614G. This is a validated assay, and again, to the Moderna boost. And again, at baseline, we have the Janssen individuals, about 15.8% of which had no detectable neutralizing antibody at baseline. All Moderna individuals had baseline detectable neutralizing antibodies, and the Pfizer then was in the middle of these two. Following boost, however, all three primary series had significant booster responses across the board, peaking at day 15 and stabilizing at day 29, with the geometric meanfold rise being 76-fold in the Janssen group owing to their lower starting point. And relative to the post-dose to Moderna results following the early stage results, this represents about 2.5-fold increase over the post-dose 2 results. The post-dose 2 peak IU50, so bridge to international standards, was 247. So we see an extremely robust homologous response after the third dose of Moderna in the Moderna group. I would also back up and just say that we saw very little difference between the age groups. And so we're not reporting the numbers here to keep it less busy, but essentially nothing that appeared significantly different between the older and the younger age group. Okay, our next set of results are going to be the Janssen booster vaccine with the full dose 5 × 10^10 viral particle. This is binding antibody results, once again, to the WA1 antigen, the wild-type strain. And again, subgroup analysis at the bottom and the entire age group collapsed together at the top. What I would first say is, once again, the Moderna group had the highest baseline binding antibody, followed by Pfizer, followed by the Janssen group. All individuals but one Janssen member had detectable antibodies. There was one individual that had no detectable antibody in the Janssen dosed group. Following the boost at day 15, we see evidence of a rise in binding antibodies across the board. However, there's about a 10-fold decrease in the response in the Janssen group as compared to the Moderna group and the Pfizer group. And again, very little difference noted amongst the age subpopulations. And here we have the neutralizing antibody results to spike D614G following the Janssen boost reported in ID50s. Again, we're reporting this as IU50 in the green. At baseline, 22% of the Janssen individuals had no detectable neutralizing antibody at day one. All the Moderna individuals had detectable antibody at day one, and about 95 to 97% of the Pfizer individuals had detectable antibody at day one. And following the Janssen boost, we do see evidence of increase in neutralizing antibodies across the board. But again, there appears to be a 7 to 10-fold increase in the mRNAs as compared to the Janssen homologous prime boost. Lastly, the Pfizer-BioNTech booster vaccination at 30 micrograms. Here's the binding antibody data. Once again, all volunteers had detectable antibody at baseline. And following the boost, and we're reporting here binding antibody to the WA1 wild-type strain, we see results that essentially mirror that of Moderna with a quite robust response across the board and a 33 geometric meanfold rise in the Janssen volunteers owing to the lower start point. No particular difference in the sub-age groups. Here we have the neutralizing antibody titers to the spike D614G following the Pfizer boost. Again, we see about 22.6% of the Janssen individuals having no detectable neutralizing antibody, as compared to about 3% of the Pfizer, and then all Moderna individuals had detectable baseline neutralizing antibody. Following the boost, it's a very similar response as compared to the Moderna product, with anywhere from 11 to 35 geometric mean fold rise in titers. And then putting this all together and trying to have a few take-home points. So at the top, we have the Moderna boost. In the middle, the Janssen. And at the bottom, we have the Pfizer-BioNTech. And first, what I would note is that the neutralizing antibodies did increase in response to any boost, irregardless of the primary vaccination series, and ranged from 4.2 all the way to 76 geometric mean fold rise. The second point I would make is that the homologous regimens, and that would be Janssen prime boost, Moderna prime boost, and Pfizer prime boost, had geometric mean fold rises ranging from 4.2 to 20, whereas the heterologous populations and groups ranged from 6.2 to 76, meaning that the heterologous had as good or higher neutralizing antibodies following the boost at day 15. A third point that I would make is that all groups, save for the homologous Janssen prime boost group, achieved post IU50 doses of greater than 100 in terms of IU50s, which has been associated with a 90.7% vaccine efficacy against symptomatic disease when analyzing Moderna results. And this was replicated in Oxford data published by VOICE, where they had a cut point of approximately 140 in international units, representing a 90% vaccine efficacy against symptomatic disease, although our data may not reflect measures of protection against severe disease or death. Okay, here are all the results I've just reported and a few comments I'll make. On the top, you'll see panels A through C representing the binding antibody. And on the bottom, panels D through E, you'll see the neutralizing antibody. In general, the day 15 titers were highest in those individuals who had the mRNA-1273 Moderna prime, so these individuals. They were in general higher following their boosts, followed by Pfizer-BioNTech and then Janssen, irrespective of the booster vaccination. Another observation that we would make is that the boost resulted in what appeared to be the highest serologic response at day 15 in the mRNA boosts, so the Moderna product and the Pfizer-BioNTech product. However, following the Janssen boost, we do see evidence of incremental rise at day 29, which would be reflective of the Ensemble 2 data, where there was incremental rise over time and then stabilization over a full 8-month period. And we're waiting for day 29 neutralizing antibody results. And the one other point that I would make on this figure is that these dots, these red dots here, here and here, this is group 4 and this is group 6, these are the individuals with high background N protein that we discovered in our post-hoc analysis. And we've charted them here just so that you can get an idea where they land within the immune response. A bit of immunogenicity with our variants of concern. Okay, so this is IgG serum binding antibody response to the WA1, Washington 1 wild type control in yellow, the alpha strain in blue, and the delta in pink. So at baseline, we see roughly 35 to 45% decrease in antibodies against the delta as compared to the wild type control. Following the Moderna boost, we see a robust response across the board, regardless of your primary vaccine series. And the degradation in antibodies as regards to the amount of antibodies detected against Delta then decreased to between 15 and 35% as compared to the wild-type control, indicating a robust boost response and possible breadth across coverage with the variants of concern. Here we see the similar results with Janssen following the Janssen boost and the primary vaccine series. You can see at day one, there's quite a bit of dispersion in the Janssen primary dosed volunteers. Following boost, all participants experienced an increase in their binding antibodies. And by day 29, all of the individuals had detectable antibody against the variants of concern. And here are the results following the Pfizer-BioNTech, again, to the wild-type control, the Alpha and the Delta. And this mirrors our Moderna results so that there's a robust response by day 15, and we don't have day 29 results as yet. And here's the compilation figure with all of the results demonstrating that all volunteers mount an antibody response, the mRNAs peaking at day 15, and the Janssen continuing to rise till day 29. Safety results. We had two serious adverse events, one an acute renal failure due to rhabdomyolysis following a fall. This was deemed unrelated to study vaccination and occurred 30 days after a Moderna boost. The second was acute cholecystitis that was termed unrelated and occurred 24 days after the Janssen booster vaccination. We had no pre-specified study halting rules met, no new onset chronic medical conditions through day 29, and had one related adverse event of special interest, which was a case of severe vomiting that led to a medically attended event the day after a Janssen booster vaccination. In terms of unsolicited AEs deemed related to the boost of any severity, we see a fairly even distribution across all three booster doses. Most were grade one or two in severity. There were four related grade three adverse events, two vomiting, one I've described following the Janssen, that was an adverse event of special interest, and vomiting in one participant who received the Moderna boost. There was also a reported grade three fatigue and one of insomnia in two individual patients or participants following the Janssen booster. And here we have our booster solicited adverse events, and I've collapsed the age groups because we didn't see a particular trend between the younger and the older age group with the low numbers that we have. You'll see this is local and systemic reactogenicity through day eight, and it really mirrors that reported in the primary series, so that 75 to 85% of individuals had experienced pain and tenderness, as well as a good amount of headache, malaise, fatigue, and myalgia, particularly in those that had received the Moderna primary vaccine series. In terms of limitations for the study, as we've mentioned, this was not randomized. It was an open label design. The study was not designed to compare between boosts. We did not control for intervals, and we did not control for patient characteristics between the primary vaccine and the boost. The correlates of protections are not completely elucidated, and the correlates for severe disease and death are even less well understood. This is only antibody data and early immunogenicity data. We do have cellular and B-cell immune responses that are still being analyzed. These data represent only early time points from the trial, and the vaccine may differ in time to reach peak responses, and there may have different durability of responses, so we will be following these participants for a full year. Our conclusions are that the use of the Moderna, the Janssen, and the Pfizer-BioNTech as booster vaccines led to recall serologic responses in all three EUA dose vaccine groups. For a primary, EUA COVID-19 vaccine, heterologous boosts elicited similar or higher serologic responses as compared to their respective homologous booster responses. The mRNA vaccines resulted in higher antibody titers in the first 28 days after the boost, and there were no significant safety concerns identified within this short time period. Again, I'd like to recognize the mix and match study team, along with the contributions of the companies who allowed us to use some of their paperwork and cross-reference, although all vaccine product was procured through government procurement offices. And with that, I'm available to take questions.
Thank you, Dr. Like. That was a very clear presentation of very complicated data. I just want to ask a point of information before we open the presentation for general questions. Primary series for Moderna and Pfizer BioNTech was two doses, and for Janssen was one dose, correct?
It was two doses, the Moderna interval being the 28-day recommended dose and the Pfizer interval being 21 days.
Making this a real-world study.
This is a real-world study. They were not dosed with us. They had already been dosed and came in for the booster portion.
Okay, thank you. Questions, Dr. Pergen?
Thanks a lot. This is a really great study you guys have put together. I had a couple questions just to remind us of the exclusion criteria for people who enrolled in the study. Mm-hmm. And can you remind us if you tried to enrich for specific high-risk populations within the study design?
So that was not the point of this study. We wanted to have a real-world medically stable individuals. So while we didn't rule them out, they did have to be medically stable. We did not take individuals who were on immunosuppression. We did take them at their word that they had not had COVID-19 or received monoclonal antibodies.
Dr. Chatterjee.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Monto. Thank you, Dr. Light, for that excellent presentation. My question is about the other groups that you alluded to. You presented the data on these nine groups. Could you enlighten us a little bit about what those other groups are and when the data from those groups will possibly become available?
Yeah, so we always built this as an adaptive design, and in fact, we're sort of building it as we were conducting it. So we started with stage one and then looped in companies as we went along. So every 2.5 to 3 weeks, we added a new stage. So we've also completed a dose arm of individuals who received the 50 microgram Moderna product, so the half dose that was just approved. And we also have a series of individuals who have received, we call it the 0.211 product, so that's the Moderna product that's 50 micrograms of the beta .351, as well as 50 micrograms of the 1273.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Carrillo.
Thank you, Arnold. Pretty clear that the early focus has been on antibody responses and neutralizing titers. It's fairly easy to do, but we've seen we heard yesterday from Moderna that even in the absence of neutralizing titers, they're still manifesting considerable protection, and we actually saw today from the J&J that with some of the newer, or whatever you want to call it, variants that we haven't seen yet in the United States, where they're more on the lines of vaccine escape means, that there's a real disconnect between preventing symptomatic infection versus protection from serious disease. So that suggests that cellular immunity is very important. There have been several reports that the cellular responses induced by the mRNA vaccines do wane over time. So it would seem that exactly when you did these in term, you may be measuring, you may get different responses measuring someone with an mRNA vaccine 3 months out versus 6 months out. And so the question is, when are we likely to begin to see some of these cellular responses, which is probably going to be very critical going forward to understand the new landscape of what we're going to see in the future from COVID?
Yeah, I can't give you an exact date, but we've already shipped the samples to the laboratories and they're underway, hopefully by the sort of mid-November, I would estimate, maybe late November, we'll start to see the earliest results. But it's literally a colossal amount of samples. We're collecting anywhere between 10,000 vials of product every week and then shipping them to the appropriate lab. So it's a logistical effort.
And what about longer follow-up in terms of antibody responses past 29 days?
Yeah, we're following them all the way to 12 months. So we have time points at 3, 6, and 12 months, and we'll be following all the volunteers through that period.
Thank you.
And it's interesting that you're seeing a little bit of waning already in the mRNA product.
Or stabilization. It wasn't a great deal. So we know that the mRNAs peak early, and it will be interesting to see what they do over time.
All right. Dr. Rubin.
Thanks for sharing your interesting data. I wonder what happened to the individuals who had no measurable neutralizing antibody, and whether there was a correlation between antibody levels before the additional dose and after.
Correlation meaning, I'm not sure I follow with the correlation.
In other words, did those who had very low titers end up with on the lower end of the elevated titers?
Yeah, that's
after,
a good question. We'll have to pull out that data. What I can say is that everyone who was negative then became positive, although a bit slower in the Janssen group. They all went positive by day 29. So it was a little bit more of a delayed response. And you might infer that that will continue to go up over time. That's something that we'll be looking at carefully.
Thank you.
To my surprise, there are no additional questions. So you must have been
clear,
crystal clear in your presentation of very complicated data. Ah, we have another hand. Dr. Pergam.
I apologize. just a question, since this has just been voted on for the second dose of the Johnson & Johnson, the flexibility in your study, does that allow you to add another subgroup to do additional boosters from the study design you have? You've added additional questions related to these other vaccines. Does that sort of study allow you to sort of ask that? Because I think that's going to be a question down the road as people that have completed a two-dose series or whatever we want to call the J&J, is there an option to do an additional boost beyond?
That's not something we discussed. We do have a separate cohort of individuals who were dosed with a primary series so that we could have early immunogenicity, and we're reserving those on hand to boost with a product that we have yet to decide or to look at results. So the flexibility of this study is pretty open-ended, and it allows us to adapt and move towards really any direction. We anticipated that there may be more vaccines that were targeting variants of concern as new variants rose in the population. And so we envisioned, you know, being able to rapidly implement new arms to this study. So it's open-ended to last out to 4 years if needed, so that we can continue to answer new questions and add arms to help us make decisions.
Kathleen, I do not see any additional raised hands. Do you?
Dr. Nelson had his hand up earlier and then went down, so I just want to see if you had a question.
Dr. Monto, I do have a question, if that's okay.
Okay, Dr. Nelson.
Thank you, Dr. Luck, for an outstanding presentation. I think we're all suitably impressed by the initiative and the design of this study and the data it will yield over the next several years. Two quick questions. I thought I heard that the solicited adverse events were similar to the primary series. We've seen data today and yesterday that second or subsequent doses may have a lower frequency. Does your data bear that out?
Yeah, from what we saw, it looked pretty similar to me. I mean, 75 to 85% reporting pain, and then a good percentage reporting headache, malaise, fatigue, and body aches. So at least from the data that we have at hand, it did look pretty similar. There aren't enough numbers to really parse that out statistically, perhaps, but it did seem that maybe there was a bit of drop-off in the older population, but again, when we collapsed all the data together, it looked very similar to the primary series.
Yeah, we all had theoretical concerns that there might be increased rates when we crossed platforms with respect to the booster. Similar question, is anybody looking at affinity or epitope mapping for cross-platform dosing, with the advantage being that maybe the quality of the antibodies produced with that booth, in addition to the actual quantity, will provide some added protection? Thank you.
Yeah, so with all the blood collections, we devote half to pre-planned assays, and the other half is for future use. So we have the flexibility to add a whole host of additional assays. We are doing B-cell assays, and whether we move to epitope mapping, et cetera, you know, that's an open-ended question, but obviously would be of great interest.
Dr. Carrillo, again.
Yeah, one other thought. Would you consider boosting with a strain change variant? Do you anticipate doing that when they become available?
Yeah, that's exactly what we had anticipated. That's why we left this as an adaptive design. We started with three groups, and we're up to 14. With a projected possible 17, we wanted to add a protein vaccine to this as well, just out of interest, but we're waiting to see, you know, where in which direction that goes.
Thank you.
Dr. Levy.
Hello, great study, and thank you for that. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. I wanted to ask whether there was any thought given to measuring innate immune responses after the heterologous boost in your design, because as you know, that could shape adaptive immune responses. It may also potentially correlate with some types of reactogenicity. So what are the plans regarding that, and what do you know about that?
Yeah, so it wasn't part of our original protocol design, but that doesn't preclude or exclude really anything, you know, that comes to the table. And if that is a direction that we want to go, we certainly have plenty of samples that we can dip into to look at those questions.
Yeah, you may be aware that Dr. Mihai Natia in the Netherlands, for example, has published that receipt of mRNA vaccine in some sense shifts the innate set point, and it would be interesting to see how that plays out in the context of a design like this.
Yeah, agreed.
Dr. Perlman.
Yeah, these data are great. Is there any thought about extending them to a vaccine efficacy study? Obviously not all zillion limbs, but pertinent limbs.
Not as part of this study. I don't know if NIH has additional thoughts about that, but it wasn't part of the design for this study. This was purely for public health purposes and to really get to the bottom of a whole host of questions that just kept arising. You know, there was a lot of debate whether we should even have Moderna followed by a Pfizer or Pfizer followed by Moderna. A lot of people felt that that wasn't going to be useful data. But, you know, I think it's real world practical questions that people want to know. Is it safe to do that? So I think there's value in looking at it in every which way.
Well, thank you very much. That seems to have exhausted the questions. Dr. Marks, are you going to give us the discussion topic for our broader discussion now?
I believe we have the discussion.
Sorry about that. Dr. Monto, what would you, we had a discussion question here. It may be that some of this is apparent. There we go.
Okay, how do you want us to approach this? This is pretty open-ended.
Could I make a suggestion, Dr. Monto, that perhaps
please do.
Maybe we can just go down the committee and just see if anyone wants to add anything in this regard. I don't think this has to be any kind of systematic, you know, where we'd like to hear the committee's impressions here. I also want to, again, just take the opportunity to thank Dr. Like. This was really, it was very nice to have this presented. It's clearly very important work, and I'm glad to be able to have the committee hear this. So I think we'd just be interested if there are any comments that the committee would like to make, and if you just want to go down the committee members and
see if they wish to make anything. What I would suggest, rather than calling on the large number of people we have on the committee, is to ask you how specifically we can help in making some recommendations about how we can be putting this into effect in terms of the scenario that we heard yesterday, that, for example, ACIP cannot do anything without an emergency use authorization from FDA. So, for example, if somebody who has received the Janssen vaccine would like to get, based on some of these data, an mRNA booster, how is that going to be done, not right away, but down the line? What kind of discussion would help you in trying to formulate the kind of EUA that would make that possible?
I think we would want to know what the committee would see. So we have data now. If you think about it, we have data, for instance, with Janssen boosted with an mRNA vaccine and mRNA vaccine boosted with Janssen vaccine. But the question is, how much more data would the committee like to see for the purposes of an emergency use authorization in this type of a scenario for kind of mix and match of the vaccines? That might be helpful.
Okay, that is a very much more focused question, and let's start going around and seeing who would like to comment about what the kind of data they would like to see to justify an emergency use authorization. Dr. Rubin.
Thanks, Dr. Monto, and I was going to ask Dr. Marks what we would need, but in fact, he's asking us, so which is nice. We just authorized additional doses of vaccines based on, in the case of Moderna at least, a very small amount of safety data. Here we have vaccines that are safe. We have modalities that we understand for delivering those vaccines. I'm pretty comfortable that with a relatively small sample size, that we can be certain of safety, given we don't need much more efficacy than the immunobridging that that we have from Dr. Like's study, I think, because it's very similar to the kinds of things that we've seen before and that we've approved on before. So I guess somewhat larger sample size for, I wish I could name a number, but a somewhat larger sample size for safety, certainly no less than the 150-ish that we had from Moderna, I think. But I'm making that up. But I think that those are all the data that I feel like we really needed.
And Dr. Marks, if you would like to respond at any point, feel free, because we'll go down the list of those who have their hands raised. But you're muted. You're muted.
Sorry, double mute. I apologize. Thank you, Dr. Rubin. That's exactly the type of feedback I think we wanted here.
Dr. Gans.
Hi. Yeah, thank you. I think it's very compelling, and as some of us alluded to, Janssen extension of the primary series, that this indication is actually something I would be interested in thinking about and helping individuals with higher risk indication. So I think that we have all already voted on the safety of these vaccines. And I would be in favor, I mean, we already have, at least with this other study, another 450, wherever it's mixed up, and for each one of them, 150. So I think we've already actually seen data points of people gotten this. I would actually urge the FDA to this quick EUA so those people benefit of this actually have.
Dr. Carrillo.
Yeah, I'll take a slightly different perspective here. I don't actually see this as an EUA consideration. I think that the safety data is great, and I think it does present potential options down the road for public health officials and our overall response to the evolving pandemic. But my concern is that a few things. One is that I know people are very highly swayed by high neutralizing titers, but we do not have a correlate of protection, and we clearly see evidence of protection from these vaccines in the absence of neutralizing titers, so there's a lot of other things going on. And the reality is that when this would be considered to be implemented in the future, because right now everybody's probably just in the process of getting boosted with whatever their primary vaccination is, we're going to be in a slightly different environment with a whole new set of variants. And so I think we may end up in a situation not too dissimilar to influenza. No one talks about what influenza vaccine did you get last year, because we don't have an EUA or an approval for a particular booster for you if you got a certain vaccine. So I think this is very informative data, I think largely in terms of safety and largely in terms of helping to better assess the overall components of the immune response that are really contributing to the critical aspects of protection, both from infection and symptomatic disease as well as serious disease. So I would not go down the EUA route. I think we'll be struggling forever with every single combination, and it's just not going to be worth the effort.
Dr. Carrillo, the only problem is that we heard yesterday from Dr. Cohen that ACIP is constrained by the fact that these are not licensed products.
But eventually,
so
these are going
to figure that one out. We've got licensed products.
Right. But these products will be licensed. I mean, I don't think we expect to be in an emergency situation forever. And I don't think we expect these to stay under EUA forever. The FDA itself does not regard EUA as an end state. So I think the focus should be on getting these products approved and doing adequate studies to demonstrate that there's a safety and there is evidence of clinical benefit from this. But I think trying to parse it out with each particular combination, we're going to be having VRBPAC meetings nonstop for the next several months if we try to do this.
I'd like to call on Dr. Cohen to give us the ACIP view about this.
Thanks, Dr. Monto. I think that there's a little bit of confusion here about whether or not FDA is talking about this as being an indication versus having some language somewhere in the EUA or fact sheet that allows for heterologous boost. And I think from a public health perspective,
in other words, it doesn't have to be specific.
Yeah, so I don't think that it needs to be that you can, I think that if there was some general language that would, I don't think there's any sort of need from a public health perspective to have a preference for mixing or matching, but I think that from a public health perspective, there's a clear need in some situations for individuals to receive a different vaccine. For example, J&J doses, while for those 14 million people who have been vaccinated, many of those individuals may not have access to a second dose of J&J. So if there's not any allowable language in the FDA fact sheets or EUA authorization, then those individuals are left behind. Additionally, the same goes for if an individual is a female who's 30 years of age who may feel like she's at risk now for a reaction after she received a first dose of J&J before the TTS was recognized. So that would allow, for example, for that woman to get a different type of vaccine. And to the contrary, it allows for example, in nursing homes where most residents received mRNA vaccines, it would allow a pharmacy to go into a nursing home and only have a single vaccine product to boost individuals who received either Moderna or Pfizer, either of the mRNA vaccines or the J&J vaccine. So I think from a public health implementation perspective, given the setting of this pandemic, it would be really important to have some allowable language. And I think the safety data that has been presented today is very supportive, especially in light of the culmination of the millions of doses of these products that we've seen given and the safety evidence from all of those vaccines.
Thank you. Very helpful. Dr. Lee.
So I want to make sure that we don't confuse the public even more than we are already. So we have approved both the boosters for the two mRNA products for ages 65 and up, and then other categories of individuals who are below that, either at high risk, either through health issues or through occupational exposure. Now in the J&J vaccine, we have approved it for all of those who got it 18 and above, so that's a much broader group. Now we're going to throw in another piece, and that will be that you could get a different vaccine. And I do know, whether rightly or wrongly, I think there is a perception in the general public that the J&J one dose is perhaps not as effective as the mRNA. And so now you've sort of set up a possibility of sort of mixing, matching, and then different groups being eligible. And I guess my question is about when that might be implemented. Some people may want to wait until they can get an mRNA. But what we're saying, though, if you're between 18 and 65 and not in those categories, if you got J&J, yes, you can get an mRNA booster. But if you got the mRNA to begin with and you don't fall in those special categories, no, you can't get that, or you're not approved for that. So I just want to point out that this is going to be some very, very messy in terms of the messaging, and I just I don't offer a suggestion, but I'm just making an observation. Thank you.
Dr. Lee, I agree with you completely about the age issue. I'm really concerned about the fact that we can only vaccinate with boosters down to 65 years of age when we know that others, especially with the Pfizer, BioNTech, are waning according to data we have. And if we have any time at the end of this, we might try to revisit that in terms of enabling language. Dr. Chatterjee.
Thank you, Dr. Monto. I just wanted to make a few remarks with the discussion that's happening right now. I think the data that were presented by Dr. Leick help us to get what I call a proof of concept, which is that heterologous boost does work, and in some cases works better than boosting with the homologous vaccine. So that's the first thing. You know, the dogma has always been, for other vaccines, you know, you always try to boost with what you've primed with. But in this instance, that seems to be different. I also think Amanda's comment about people with allergies, Dr. Cohen's comment about people with allergies, I think that that is a very important one, that if someone is allergic to one of these vaccines, they have the opportunity then to get a booster dose with a different vaccine to which hopefully they would not be allergic. With regards to Dr. Marks's comments about what else would we like to see, I have a few ideas. The first is, these are data primarily in adults, and certainly like to see what happens in children with regard to heterologous boosting. The second thing is the longevity of this boosted antibody response. I'm sure that these folks are going to be followed longer term to see how long these antibodies last. A third area that I think deserves attention is underrepresented minorities. There are very few people who are actually included as a percentage, maybe, but if you look at the absolute numbers, those are very, very small in each of the different groups. And I would encourage the folks who are conducting these studies to actually expand that if possible. And then the last point I'd like to make is about cellular immunity. The point's been made before that we are only looking at antibody responses, which is easy to measure and easy to look at, but it would be, I think, critically important to see what happens to the cellular immunity as well as we try to do this heterologous boosting. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Sawyer.
Thanks, Dr. Monto. So to Dr. Mark's question, what else do we need? I'm sold already, and that's because I agree completely with Dr. Cohn's comment that we need flexibility and improved access for everybody, which the flexibility of being able to mix and match will allow. You know, I think all of these extra data points that can be collected going forward are going to be important, but I think the sooner we let this happen in the most straightforward way possible, the better off we are. Obviously, it's already happening. We just are tracking it indirectly through the VAERS reporting and or the BSD, but this way I think it's going to improve overall access. So I'm in favor of getting this, whatever is required from the FDA perspective, to allow broader use of the mixing and matching strategy.
Dr. Pergam.
Thanks, Arnold. It's really interesting. I think we're in a situation where we've just approved a booster for J&J, and we have data that suggests that the mRNA vaccine boosts, at least according to antibody responses, and to Mike Carilla's point, we don't understand the T-cell immunity piece, which is coming, looks better. So I think this is a challenge for people out in public to sort of sort this out and to make decisions about what they're going to do. And I know we're hearing this on the, you know, from our perspective, that we have to be thoughtful about it. I think, you know, to Dr. Cohn's issue, that a little bit of flexibility would be helpful, but I think the FDA is going to have to be more specific about which particular groups would be eligible to do mix and match. that maybe it needs to be people with a known, abnormal response to a primary vaccine dose or something more specific, but there needs to be some flexibility. I think the way that they've worded it with the immunosuppressed population was helpful in the sense that if you couldn't get the primary dose series that you had, if you had Pfizer as an example, you were allowed to get Moderna as a second dose. Are there, is there ways to sort of couch that language to get that a little bit of flexibility around that? Because I think right now, state health departments and others are being very to the letter of the law, not allowing second doses for any other, or a booster dose with any other version. So I'm leaning towards being more permissive to some of these, but I think we really have to think about not making it so that the de rigueur that everyone who gets Johnson & Johnson is going to go get an mRNA vaccine without all of the data in place.
Dr. Marks, would you like to reply to that, or shall we park this and go with questions later for you? You're muted again.
Sorry, there's some noise in the background here, and I really didn't want to have you have to hear it. So thanks very much. Sorry. I appreciate the perspective here, and there are clearly challenges here, and I think we'll have to take these back and think about them. But if I could just summarize at least a little what I heard here, is it does seem like there again some consensus that this is an important option for people to have. Some would like a little more data. Some feel like this is enough data. And certainly whatever we did, we would be looking to collect more data in the real world. But there are some challenges associated with it. I think Dr. Coella really made clear, and I think rightfully so, that we don't know from these short-term studies what the longer-term effect of mix and match will be, and we just don't have those data. But I think to the extent that I think the committee here has provided us with some food for thought. I think we got what we needed from this discussion.
And we have a number of other people who want to tell you more.
happy if they'd like to.
All right. Dr. Gans.
Thank you. I just want to make sure. I mean, I know pieces have been said, and always so wonderful to hear the thoughtful conversation that comes out of this. And I think one thing that I would say, the reason why we're often getting a lot of feedback from the public about confusion and this was said, that was said, is that we like to have a very robust debate so that we make sure that pieces of us are picked up for future study. As Dr. Marks has said, this is a real-life event that we're learning as we go. What I really would like to iterate is that previously many of us had concerns about the word boost for the previous vote, and if we got rid of that, that would actually solve a lot of the confusion that Dr. Lee was talking about, because we did have a boost for certain populations and people already had what we thought was a primary series, and now we argued earlier that the primary series for the Janssen vaccination should be two doses, and so that's really not considered a boost, so it's more allowable, and people who had gotten that of all ages can get that. So I think if we clean a lot of that language up, it actually won't be confusing. I also just really need to iterate that because of the way that the EUA is, and it's so restrictive, and other bodies can't make necessarily the recommendations, I think it's really important for us to think about how we allow people who have gotten what they've gotten to take advantage of the data in real time. We keep asking for real-time data, we get real-time data, and then we say we need more. So I would urge the FDA to really allow us or whomever the language in a more rapid fashion than waiting. I think it's been a definite down, it's all challenging, but I think we can.
Thank you, Dr. Gantz. The problem is we're not going to get away from the fact that the primary series for two of the vaccines that were approved as two doses and the primary series for the other is one dose. And that's what you get in trouble with just looking at the results from the mix and match study. Dr. Annunziata.
Thank you, Dr. Monto. So this has been a really interesting discussion and really appreciate the data that was shown. I just want to share from an industry perspective, following up on what Dr. Cohen had said, that, you know, it's quite typical in vaccine programs to provide interchangeability data from studies to allow for flexibility that's often required for a successful vaccination program. And so from my view, I think that understanding that this heterologous boosts are not detrimental to say, or do not appear to be detrimental to safety or immunogenicity, can be used to allow that type of flexible language that the FDA could work with sponsors to incorporate into either labels or EUAs. And this would be useful, I think, from a real-world perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Annunziata. Dr. Moore.
Thanks, Dr. Mono. So one thing that hasn't been raised and I think is important is an advantage to the J&J vaccine that we don't have for the other vaccines is that the data that we have now is based on a very large global RCT that has been followed out over time, shows really clear durability of vaccine effectiveness, although it's clearly not peaking at the same level as the mRNA vaccines. So the shorter-term studies in mixing antigens aren't going to catch that unless you follow people out for a longer period of time, in which case it may be that mixing with the J&J vaccine actually gives you a very clear benefit of a long-duration vaccine efficacy. That's just something to consider in all of this.
Thank you, and I think long-term follow-up is going to be key here in terms of a number of elements, including those who get the get boosted and those who don't get boosted in terms of the value of revaccination. Dr. Meisner.
Thank you, Dr. DeMonto. I just want to make a few points. First of all, in terms of the heterologous boosting, we don't, as we've said, we don't know what the correlate of immunity is. We're placing a lot of emphasis on in vitro data in terms of neutralizing antibodies. And so I guess the one question I have is, do we need some efficacy studies or effectiveness studies to really come to a conclusion on how beneficial a heterologous boost would be? And secondly, remember there are many COVID vaccines, and so if we're talking about a boost, a heterologous boost, I mean, it would have to be very clear that we're talking about the three vaccines that are authorized or licensed here in the United States. And I just worry that that could become a very confusing message for people. And I guess this is for the FDA, there certainly wouldn't be a preference for heterologous boosting in contrast to homologous boosting, because that would make it so complicated for people who have already completed a primary series and received a boost. And I just wonder, I think the wording, as has been said, will be so important because it could be quite confusing for the general public.
Dr. Fuller.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Monto. I just want to remind all of us, and from my perspective as a virologist who studied entry, that all three of these approved at the moment or vaccines are to the spike protein of coronavirus, and there's certainly a colleague here who studies coronavirus, but they may not be as different as we might think. The platform is different, but the antigen itself is the spike protein, which is so key to the entry of coronavirus, so for coronavirus SARS-2. So for the public, that messaging coming from the FDA and CDC and others may be useful to say that regardless of how you get it, you're still getting immunity to a key molecule or key protein that this virus uses. And so that may be less confusing and allow the flexibility and access that is so important to do the things that Dr. Cohen mentioned at first. So just a comment about that it's all the spike protein and that there may be subtle differences, but because we've seen the studies on all of them that and all of them have passed the safety and efficacy, that they may not be that really different in what they do to the immune system specifically. Just a point on entry in virology.
Thank you, Dr. Wharton. Oh, Dr. Fuller. What happened there? Dr. Wharton.
You're muted.
I need this one.
You're muted, Dr. Wharton.
Dr. Wharton, at the top of the screen, can you click on the phone symbol to unmute yourself? All right, let's come back to her.
Okay. Dr. Marks, you have your hands raised now. Oh, everybody's clearing themselves. Dr. Levy. Okay, we got you.
Yeah, I wanted to add another wrinkle to the conversation. We've heard from several people, several committee members, that it will be confusing to the public if we now start to consider authorizations for mixed or heterologous vaccines. And on the other hand, you know, we have to follow the science. We're still in a pandemic here, and if there's opportunity to offer benefit, that's our job. And besides, many Americans are taking matters into their own hands, and I'm reading in the media that people are getting boosters or mixing different products through their, you know, primary care providers or by not revealing what they got before. And so in the real world, all these kind of combinations or extra boosters are already happening. So I think it's a matter of some urgency for FDA to help sort out what is admittedly a complicated and challenging scenario, but we can't hide from it. And I do think we need to give guidance to the public. So that's my perspective. Thank you.
Right. And I couldn't agree more. And I think that is one of the issues about the age group for the boosters, because people are reading in the reading that there's waning of protection, and they are getting boosters. Dr. Hildreth.
Thank you, Dr. Monto. I have a comment to make that goes back to earlier in the day, and I wish I had said it earlier, but Dr. Marks has gone on record to say that the FDA team has not fully evaluated the data presented to them, and we voted to approve this without them having done so. So I think it's really, really important that it be clarified in public on the record that they're going to do so, and that if there are some challenges that arise in that analysis, that appropriate actions will be taken, because we have up to this point, as my colleague just said, followed the science. I think it's really important for the public to know that that's going to happen in this case, just like it's happened in all the other cases. And there are numerous times when the FDA presenter said that we've not validated this data. That was confirmed by Dr. Marks. So I think it's important for the public to know that that is going to be done, and if there are things that are challenging that comes out of that analysis, appropriate steps will be taken. I just want to make that point. I think it's really important.
This is Peter Marsh. That point's well taken. I think just by way of full transparency, I think the one place that may be challenging for us to move timely on that, I think point's very well taken about the immunogenicity data we have for Janssen. The challenge will be on their larger 30,000 patient trial, where it's very that could be quite slow going, and I hazard to guess how long it could take us to get through that. But you have our commitment that for the trials that we're relying on for immunogenicity, the data that we're using from trial 3001, those are the kinds of data that we can ensure and with our usual rigor.
Dr. Nelson. Dr. Nelson?
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Monto. I appreciate it. I go to the FDA's own description of emergency use authorization. An emergency use authorization is a mechanism to facilitate the availability and use of medical countermeasures, including vaccines. The words facilitate the availability and use, I think, is where I've centered my discussions and votes over the last 2 days. Is the data supportive of enough for safety and efficacy to allow and enable options for the care of the patients in the U.S.? As of exactly 6 months ago today, 76.7 million have been classified as fully vaccinated. That's the number that's facing decisions with respect to boosters as the data recommendations emerge from both the FDA and the CDC. In light of the discussions, I fully agree that the data isn't fully mature or exactly a mandate that we can get to the level of recommending these boosters in a heterologous fashion, but I do believe that we should be enablers in this respect and help those in need by providing access to these vaccines through the agent of an EUA. The bar for full approval is certainly higher, and I agree that either correlates of protection or actual clinical evidence and protection is needed to get there, but I believe we have enough on the table today to at least include some enabling language in an EUA. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nelson. Dr. Wharton.
Thank you. I'd like to reiterate how important it is from a programmatic perspective to have a little bit of flexibility to deal with these circumstances that do happen, like the pharmacy coming into long-term care, not having to bring two mRNA vaccines to vaccinate the population, or the people who don't really know what vaccine they got or don't have their records. So I think we all understand why the EUA process is as constrained as it is. But it's also important if a little bit of flexibility can be provided to address these programmatic circumstances that happen, as well as individuals who may have specific preferences for safety or other reasons to receive a different vaccine than they received initially, I think that will just be enormously helpful.
Thank you very much. Dr. Nelson, I'm going to ask you a question since you brought up the wording of the EUA, and that is in terms of the cutoff at age 65 for the general population, except for those in special risk groups, because my concern is, again, that ACIP is restricted in doing anything until they have an EUA, and is there a way, in your mind, to get a little more flexibility about going down in age should we see dramatically a more breakthrough? We know we hate that word, infections in, let's say, a population down to age 50 or down to age 40.
Dr. Monto, it's an excellent question, and my thinking on this has evolved. I think the original stating of the question to us was, does the data or evidence support the need for those broader populations? And I still am of the thinking that it isn't quite there yet. I am in favor of expanding options for providers and patients in risk intolerant individuals who may venture or have the need to seek those additional doses in that age group under 65 with appropriate education with respect to adverse effects and risk associated with those decisions. I definitely echo the concerns of everybody that this is getting ultimately extremely confusing with respect to what patients are confronted with decision making. And there is a need to be clear with respect to full recommendations and options. But the ACIP and CDC, and I think in collection with the FDA and other experts around the country, can get to that end point by including more inclusive language. Thank you.
Dr. Marks, do you have any comments about this, about how we can get a little more flexibility so we don't have to meet and discuss every time we want to go down in age group, as the Israeli data, for example, about the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine becomes more obvious in the United States, which I think it will.
Thanks, Dr. Monto. And I maybe chalk this up to a novice mistake on my part. I think when we tried to be very flexible for the committee yesterday in the question, we might have done better to have been more specific and said, based on the, I think for the Pfizer-BioNTech data, the data we saw from Israel, which granted, Israel is not the same as the U.S., but there were characteristics of safety that we'd like to believe probably carry over, and the waning of protection for that particular vaccine may. And the question would be, you know, I think below the age of 40, I think the data are not there. The question is from, it does, they did present at least what seemed, again, just N of one me, as data that seemed compelling in the 40 and up age range. So the question is, does the committee feel like if we were to make a recommendation in our EUA for 40, then actually that lets the CDC decide if they would like to come and use, they can keep it at 65, they can come down to 50, they can come down to 40. Now what we would do is we'd still, if we did that, we would still keep in the distinction for, you know, for 18 to 40 then, for the risk groups, that would stay the same. We tweak the language as suggested by some, but we would bring the general population age down if the committee, the sense of the committee was that made sense to.
This is the sense of the committee. This is not with a vote, in other words.
Correct. I mean, if the committee would like to vote, I suppose we could huddle and get that together.
No, we don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Because
the sense of the committee.
They'll count, people will start counting who votes no.
Right. No, I did hear several committee members. I actually heard, when I went back through my notes from yesterday, there were several committee members who made very compelling statements about their concerns were around the issue of risk benefit in somebody who was 30 or less in males, and I think those were very reasonable concerns. I think the idea of a cut point of 40, the incidence of myocarditis really below the age of 40 is not a major concern in males. And the question would be then, is the committee, there was also the issue of people who were below 65 who might have comorbidities that put them, maybe they weren't, quite in one of the risk categories, but still might benefit. So I would ask the committee just to comment on that and their comfort level. And I just want to also thank the committee because I think the discussion that was just had on boosters was remarkably helpful for us at FDA, but I think also for the public to see a very complicated concept that was presented very well by the presenter and then really discussed elegantly by all of the committee members. So thank you.
Right. And in terms of the age groups, we know that risks differ within the age group, let's say 40 or 50 and older, including minority groups and people who are living in disadvantaged settings, which really don't fit into some of the recommendations that we have right now. Dr. Ganz.
Hi, I'm hoping you can hear me better. I hear from Twitter that I'm not
hearing
very well.
We hear you loud and clear.
All right, perfect. I know you do. Anyway, I really appreciate Dr. Marks, the opportunity to think about that because since the September meeting, I think several of us have felt that there should be further consideration to allowing individuals again down to I was the first one to say 50, whatever, 40 sounds reasonable because of the myocarditis, the opportunity to be further protected by a booster. We're seeing more and more evidence of without correlates of protection, and we just have to sort of think about that, and we got to leave that. But without correlates of protection, we are seeing the correlates that we're using and that we use a lot in other vaccines as well. Waning. And so I do think that's very important and I appreciate it. And I would like to put forth my thoughts that I think that that's a very important way in which we can help individuals at this point in the pandemic that we've reached.
Dr. Rubin.
I think I'm very supportive of the way that Dr. Marks formulated what he said just now. In fact, we're worried about risk and benefit. We're not really worried about a flat-out no for one group or another. And if, for example, things were to change on the ground and it was more important for younger people to get it, I'm very in favor of allowing the flexibility for that FDA allow the flexibility for at least for ACIP. To make a recommendation about that. So I think that as new data are coming in, remember last time around we saw the Israeli data from age 60 and up, and now we're seeing 40 and up, and we're getting a much better idea of risk. So I think it's a very good idea to give some leeway.
Dr. Carrillo.
Thank you, Arnold. Yeah, I guess one question I would ask Dr. Marks is I think part of the area of confusion, one aspect of the confusion is that when we say immunity is waning, what are the implications of that? Because I think there is, at least in the general public, and actually quite a bit in the medical and public health community, that there is an assumption that
Okay.
All right, go ahead. You are back connected. Take it away.
Yeah, so I think when we talk about, when we say waning immunity,
your
I think in many people's
been
minds,
on.
Particularly the public, but I think in general also with many in the healthcare and public health community, that an increase in infections is obviously going to lead to an increase in symptomatic infections, is going to lead to an increase in severe infections and hospitalizations and death. And what we're seeing actually is not that there is a divergence, and that is we may be getting, many people may be suffering breakthrough infections, but the protection from severe disease is still holding up quite well for all of the vaccines. Now, that doesn't mean they'll hold on forever. We still have to evaluate durability, but I think it's important to ask when the concern is for waning immunity, what exactly are we trying to target by trying to increase the flexibility and increase the availability of vaccines for the population? If we're trying to drive to zero COVID, I think that's not going to work. So I think we just need to be a little bit more careful and deliberate in terms of what impact do we actually are we actually trying to create here.
Dr. Marks, would you care to comment from the Israeli data about holding up against severe disease? Because from what I understand, it's starting to wane against severe disease as well. I know hospitalizations have gone up in the vaccinated.
Dr. Monto, that's correct. And actually, there are data that have been actually, some was submitted to the docket. There are data that are coming from various sources. It's kind of almost a grassroots data collection of breakthrough infections in healthcare providers and others that are younger than age 60 that have ended up hospitalized or with what would qualify as severe COVID. Now, we have not, obviously, those are not FDA-reviewed data, but on an anecdotal basis, I think it makes us realize that we're concerned that what was seen in Israel could be seen here. And I think going back to what Dr. Rubin said, I think we want to prevent severe, we don't want to have a wave of severe COVID-19 before we deploy boosters. I think we want to, when we see waning, start to prevent that from happening. I agree with you, though. We're not looking here to stop every last case of COVID. I think Dr. Offit said that more elegantly than I could previously. So I think there is a balance here, and again, going back to what Dr. Rubin said, in this particular case, it's a risk-benefit issue, and I think if we're not seeing severe COVID-19 in the younger population yet, the benefit-risk there, so we don't go down below age 40, especially because there we know there's a myocarditis risk in males. That might be more of an issue. So I think the flexibility is helpful. I think I was on at a meeting this morning with WHO, and I think the word of the day was agility. Agility has been probably one of the most important things to have in this pandemic, and that's what I think we just want to have here.
Yeah, and my only point, Peter, is that I think we need to be clear. When we say waning immunity and we need to do something about that, I think we need to be clear what we're really targeting in terms of the clinical impact we expect to have.
So, point well taken. So I think the appearance of cases. Yep.
Okay, Dr. Pergam, we have a lag there.
Thanks, Arnold. I do think I want to come back to something that Peter Marks said at the beginning, that there is this, you know, although we can't prevent every infection with boosters, and I think that's really key, we need to sort of get away from this idea that a booster is going to prevent every single infection. The idea that we can prevent additional infections, and some of those, does provide some value in the sense that COVID does have tremendous downstream effects, even for those who are not hospitalized. And so I think whenever we can prevent significant morbidity in a population, there's advantages to that. And I think if we are starting to see this concern in these groups, which many of us have seen, you know, bits and pieces of this data, and certainly the Israeli data suggests this, I'd really be in the camp that would definitely be moving towards a lower age range for allowing boosters, partially for that reason, and because we know that hospitalizations and deaths are going to lag. That what we're going to see is primary infections first and then those later, and we don't want to be in a situation as we're coming into the winter with additional people coming into the hospital because of changes. So I'm very supportive of this. In fact, I think at the last meeting we talked about Pfizer, I was supportive of going down to a lower age range.
Dr. Rubin, I believe you may have the last word. No, we just had Dr. Levy wants to come back again, so you go next.
Wait,
Dr. Rubin.
You have the last word because I just I left my hand up. Sorry.
Oh, okay. So, Dr. Levy.
We don't know what, this is a dynamic pandemic. We don't know what the winter will bring, what the dynamic of spread will be, what variants may emerge, and also what new research will come forward in terms of the impact of the pandemic on those younger age groups, including potentially long COVID and how that might play out in young individuals and even children. So I think we need to keep an open mind. Also keep open mind about the fact that if we can reach herd immunity, then there are direct and indirect benefits of the booster potentially, and the Israeli data spoke to that. It appeared from the Israeli data yesterday to my eye that they may have seen something along the lines of herd immunity as they rolled out their booster campaign. So this is a complex topic, and I think we need to follow the data and keep an open mind, and I'm generally supportive of coming down in age on the boosters, and I look forward to those conversations. Thank you.
Dr. Perlman.
Yeah, I just want to say that in general, I wasn't a fan of reducing the cutoff to a lower age because I think the severe disease isn't terribly great in that population, but hearing all these arguments, I would support that now more. I think the thing I really want to say is I hope we can present this in a way that's not confusing for the public, because there's already what we do is we follow the science, we listen to what we see, but the people who aren't doing this, they think that the rules are changing all the time. So I just hope we can do this in a way that doesn't look like we're changing the rules all the time.
Thank you, Dr. Perlman. And now, finally, the last word for Dr. Cohen.
Thanks. I will let all of those comments stand as they were excellent comments. But I think I just want to leave the committee with a reminder that already 60% of adults aged 18 to 64 do fall into one of those two categories. So you could argue, either way on that. One, we have access and availability to a large portion of that group who have the option of getting vaccinated. But you could also argue that there's a small portion, so 40% of U.S. adults aren't included in that. And so it is a complicated, those two bullet points on high-risk conditions and occupational risk are very complicated and already encompass a huge portion of the U.S. population.
Dr. Cohen, as somebody who experienced the dropping of ages for influenza vaccine for just the reason of trying to avoid confusion about whether you go into a risk category or not, that's one of the reasons why I'm a very strong advocate of doing something that's understandable and age-based. Okay, this draws our lengthy meeting going on for 2 days to an end. I think we have been very successful in voting for two products to get emergency use authorization, recommending that they get emergency use authorization, and made some important points in terms of discussion. This concludes the meeting, and I would like to hand this over to Prabha to Dr. Marks, you will have the honor of closing the meeting. Please.
No. I'll hand it over to Dr. Atrey in a moment. I promise I'm not going to ask any questions, any more questions to the committee. I just really want to sincerely thank all the members of the committee, because I really feel like every member of the committee spoke up, and we really got a lot of very good feedback. We have a lot to digest on our end, but I greatly appreciate this, and I also really greatly appreciate the dialogue that I think it has been wonderful in a public venue. So thank you all so much. I also need to thank a number of individuals. The staff from FDA worked tirelessly to go through a tremendous amount of information and to try to verify as much of it as they possibly could before this meeting, and incredibly grateful to that. And also very grateful to our ACOM staff, the advisory committee staff, who really put on an incredibly technically flawless meeting over the past 2 days. So, yes, there are always little glitches, but given that we're all in separate locations, it was quite remarkable. So thank you so much, and thank you to all of you. And now I'll turn it over to Dr. Atrey. Thank you, Dr. Monto, as well. Thank you for a wonderful chairing this meeting. Thanks. Dr. Atrey?
You're muted.
You're muted. Might as well end on that one. There we go. Perfect way to end the day.
We just wanted to give you a little bit of a glitch, Mike. So anyway, thank you, Dr. Marks and Dr. Mancho, for a wonderful meeting, and then we appreciate everything you do. And so with this remark, the meeting is adjourned formally now, 3:28 p.m.
All right. Well, thank you all, and let me extend that thank you for attending, and I will tell you when we are clear. So, studio, you can conclude this meeting for us.